Chapter 8. The Ethics of Engineering Ourselves. Our history provides some wonderful examples of humans using technology to cure diseases, enhance our potential, explore the cosmos, and preserve our planet. We also have many examples of our using technology to kill and enslave each other, sow dissent, and destroy our surroundings. Our tools are agnostic. The variable is the values we individually and collectively apply when figuring out how we'll use them. The same will be true for the incredibly powerful tools of the genetic revolution. How we understand and apply these tools will significantly determine our future as a species. Each and all of our answers to the core questions of the genetic revolution will add up to the future trajectory of our species. There are no easy answers to the critical questions of complexity, responsibility, diversity, and equity the genetics revolution will raise, but a better understanding of the ethical issues at stake is a critical first step. We humans are each massively complex biological systems embedded in and constantly interacting with the even more complex ecosystems around us. Each of our genes performs multiple functions and interacts with other genes in ways we still don't fully understand. Even when we identify a gene that's doing something bad in one context, there's often a very real possibility the same gene is helping us in some other context. We've seen that people who inherit a copy of the sickle cell mutation from each of their parents often suffer terribly from the disease. Those who inherit only one copy don't have sickle cell disease, but can often possess a very significant natural resistance to malaria. Eliminating the sickle mutation from humans would end the suffering of sickle cell disease, but potentially increase the suffering from malaria. Perhaps we could solve that problem by creating a more effective malaria drug, or we could use a gene drive to decimate the population of mosquitoes that transmit malaria. But if we wiped out too many mosquitoes with a gene drive, we'd face the potential danger of crashing the ecosystems in which they live and doing even more damage to ourselves. Each of these steps solves a particular problem, but for all we know, creates a new problem requiring an even greater intervention, and so on down the line. It's like the old Peter, Paul, and Mary song we used to sing at summer camp. I know an old lady who swallowed a cow. I don't know how she swallowed the cow. She swallowed the cow to catch the goat. She swallowed the goat to catch the dog. She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed that fly. Perhaps she'll die. Given that we still have so little understanding of how we function relative to the complexity of our biology, some ethicists argue, wouldn't we be better off not even attempting to play the role believers assign to God? As the conservative bioethicist Leon Cass wrote in the report of the George W. Bush-appointed U.S. Commission on Bioethics, "The dignity of being human, rooted in the dignity of life itself and flourishing in a manner seemingly issuing only in human pride, completes itself and stands tallest when we bow our heads and lift our hearts in recognition of powers greater than our own. The fullest dignity of the godlike animal is realized in its acknowledgement and celebration of the divine." Harvard philosopher Michael Sandel made a similar point in his Atlantic article and then book, The Case Against Perfection. "To believe that our talents and powers are wholly our own doing," he writes, "is to misunderstand our place in creation, to confuse our role with God's." This isn't just a philosophical position. We've already heard how early-stage embryos can be mosaics of different types of cells that make it difficult to determine whether a potentially harmful mutation will wind up a real problem for a future child or not. We've seen how even the most seemingly determinative of single-gene mutations don't always cause the disease they usually do. With so much at stake, why wouldn't we just take the safer route of trusting nature and our own biology even with all of its bugs, shortcomings, and sometimes dangerous mutations, that's evolved over billions of years. Because we are humans, that's why. The moment our ancestors made tools, they were challenging the environment as they found it. The moment we started planting crops, clearing fields, and creating medicines to fight off the terrible natural diseases afflicting us, we were giving the middle finger to nature as it was. Although we have good reasons to not want to cut down our forests, poison our air and oceans, and kill off the other species sharing our planet, our history with nature as we found it is a history of war. Nature conspired to kill us through hostile weather, predation, starvation, and disease, and we fought back with everything we had. We didn't live in harmony with nature. We balanced respect for nature with outright war against it. We would all agree that ants are part of nature, and so are ant hills. Birds are part of nature, and so are nests. Humans, too, are part of nature. What else could we be? If so, are not our shopping malls, nuclear bombs, and CRISPR edits also part of nature? We would have no need to play God if the world we found ourselves inhabiting was less hostile. Darwin described nature as clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horribly cruel. If God exists and is benign, it's fair to ask, why is God not playing God? If the world is in God's image as it is, why do we fight natural diseases like cancer at all? If it is not, why would we impose limits to what we might do to continue making the world a better and safer place for us? If God, for those who believe in the concept, didn't want us to live in caves fighting off disease, starvation, predators, and the elements, isn't everything from stone tools to fire to editing our genome part of doing our bit to complete God's unfinished business? But if, on the other hand, this God is agnostic about us, shouldn't we do what we can to defend and promote our species while protecting the ecosystems around us? This leads to the logical conclusion not that we should never play God, but that we must, but wisely and in balance with our surroundings. We will never have perfect knowledge of the genome, just like we never had perfect knowledge of fire before we started harnessing it, cancer before we started treating it, or domesticated crops before we started eating them. In each case, we balanced the costs and benefits and moved forward with imperfect information and a hunger to learn and do more. The same is true with genetic technologies. The bigger the step we consider taking to advance the genetic revolution, the more the potential costs will and should weigh on us. Continuing to conduct research is clearly the right thing to do. Making non-heritable genetic changes in people to help fight disease is also well on the path to widespread acceptance. Selecting and gene-editing embryos will be bigger steps and rightly engender more conversation and scrutiny. But it would be folly to suggest that our species needs to wait for perfect knowledge to move forward. We can't and we won't. We are the hominins who climbed down from the trees and then conquered the world. We're filled with optimism and hubris. It's built into our operating system. Opponents of any heritable genetic modifications warning of the slippery slope, where each step leads to the next, are in this sense not wrong. Each small step that scientists, doctors, or governments take in the direction of human genetic engineering will justify the next small step. If it's okay to incorporate another woman's donated mitochondria to help parents prevent a child from being born with mitochondrial disease, why couldn't heritable genetic changes be made to eliminate other terrible diseases? If it's okay to select an embryo who won't die young from Huntington's disease or doesn't have disrupted copies of the APOE4 gene that significantly increases its chances of getting early-onset Alzheimer's, why couldn't we select one likely to live an extraordinarily long and healthy life? If we can mix and match genetic materials to make pigs with human hearts for transplant, why can't we mix and match genes from multiple humans to ensure our future children have the strongest human heart or other organ or capacity we can provide them. Genetic illness and genetic wellness are not discrete neighboring countries. Rather, Siddhartha Mukherjee beautifully writes in The Gene, wellness and illness are continuous kingdoms, bounded by thin, often transparent, borders. There is nothing inherently wrong with a slippery slope. We just need to be mindful of the direction in which we are sliding. Decisions about whether or not to genetically select or alter pre-implanted embryos are made by adults, but their real impact is on future children. Genetic conservatives, some of whom are political liberals, make the case that actively deciding the genetics of future children takes agency away from those children. But how much choice do children have about their mother's prenatal nutrition or stress levels during pregnancy, or whether they are sent, like many young South Korean kids, to cram schools from an early age to increase their chances of admission to the best universities and later success? While genetic conservatives argue we have a moral obligation to not alter future generations because they have no say in the matter, others contend just the opposite. Oxford bioethicist Julian Savulescu is a key voice asserting that parents have a moral obligation to create children with the best chance of the best life. He argues that couples who decide to have a child have a significant moral reason to select the child who, given his or her genetic endowment, can be expected to enjoy the most well-being. Oxford's Nick Bostrom arrives at the same conclusion when he suggests we deploy what he calls the reversal test when figuring out whether it is morally justified to make a given genetic alteration to a future human. Bostrom's argument is that if some people feel that making a change in one direction is bad, say genetically engineering a person to eliminate a genetic disease, they would have to articulate why doing the opposite, that is, genetically engineering a person to add a genetic disease, would be justified, because this is in effect what they would be doing. Because no one could logically argue for genetically engineering humans to add diseases, this logic structure implicitly favors human enhancement. Arguments like Savulescu's and Bostrom's have been attacked as morally repugnant by opponents who believe this justifies valuing one life more than another, denigrates disabled people, misunderstands what constitutes a good life, conflates genetic therapies and enhancements, and commodifies future offspring. In his 2018 book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, science journalist Carl Zimmer warns against what he calls a genetic essentialism that reduces the complexity of humans and humanity to mere genetics. All of these criticisms raise the specter of modern-day eugenics. The eugenics claim is not a spurious one. It hovers, in fact, over the entire prospect of human genetic engineering like a dark cloud. The term eugenics combines the Greek roots for good and birth. Although coined in the 19th century, the concept of selective breeding and human population culling has a more ancient history. Infanticide was written into Roman law and practiced widely in the Roman Empire. A father shall immediately put to death, Table 4 of the 12 Tables of Roman Law stated, a son who is a monster or has a form different from that of the human race. In ancient Sparta, city elders inspected newborns to ensure that any who seemed particularly sickly would not survive. The German tribes, pre-Islamic Arabs, and ancient Japanese, Chinese, and Indians all practiced infanticide in one form or another. The 1859 publication of Darwin's The Origins of Species didn't just get scientists thinking about how finches evolved in the Galapagos, but about how human societies evolved more generally. Applying Darwin's principles of natural selection to human societies, Darwin's cousin and scientific polymath Sir Francis Galton theorized that human evolution would regress if societies prevented their weakest members from being selected out. In his influential books, Hereditary Talent and Character, 1885, and then Hereditary Genius, 1889, he outlined how eugenics could be applied positively by encouraging the most capable people to reproduce with each other, and negatively by discouraging people with what he considered disadvantageous traits from passing on their genes. These theories were embraced by mainstream scientific communities and championed by luminaries like Alexander Graham Bell, John Maynard Keynes, Woodrow Wilson, and Winston Churchill. Although his work was partly in the spirit of the Victorian England times, Galton was then, and even more now, what we would call a racist. "The science of improving stock," he wrote, "takes cognizance of all the influences that tend in however remote degree to give the more suitable races or strains of blood a better chance of prevailing speedily over the less suitable than they otherwise would have had." In 1909, Galton and his colleagues established the journal Eugenics Review, which argued in its first edition that nations should compete with each other in race betterment, and that the number of people with prenatal conditions in hospitals and asylums should be reduced to a minimum through sterilization and selective breeding. Galton's theories gained increasing prominence internationally, particularly in the New World. Although eugenics would later accrue sinister connotations, many of the early adopters of eugenic theories were American progressives who believed science could be used to guide social policies and create a better society for all. "We can intelligently mold and guide the evolution in which we take part," progressive theologian Walter Rauschenbusch wrote. "God," Johns Hopkins economic professor Richard Ely asserted, "works through the state." Many American progressives embraced eugenics as a way of making society better by preventing those considered unfit and defective from being born. "We know enough about eugenics so that if that knowledge were applied, the defective classes would disappear within a decade," University of Wisconsin President Charles Van Hise opined. In the United States, the science of eugenics became intertwined with disturbing ideas about race. Speaking to the 1923 Second International Congress of Eugenics, President Henry Osborne of New York's American Museum of Natural History argued that scientists should ascertain through observation and experiment what each race is best fitted to accomplish. If the Negro fails in government, he may become a fine agriculturalist or a fine mechanic. The right of the state to safeguard the character and integrity of the race or races on which its future depends is, to my mind, as incontestable as the right of the state to safeguard the health and morals of its peoples. As science has enlightened government in the prevention and spread of disease, it must also enlighten government in the prevention of the spread and multiplication of worthless members of society, the spread of feeble-mindedness, of idiocy, and of all moral and intellectual as well as physical diseases. Major research institutes like Cold Spring Harbor, funded by the likes of the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Institution of Washington, and the Kellogg Race Betterment Foundation, provided a scientific underpinning for a progressive eugenics movement growing in popularity as a genetic determinism swept the country. The American Association for the Advancement of Science put its full weight behind the eugenics movement through its trend-setting publication, Science. If Mendel showed there were genes for specific traits, the thinking went, it was only a matter of time before the gene dictating every significant human trait would be found. Ideas like these moved quickly into state policies. Indiana, in 1907, became the first U.S. state to pass a eugenics law making sterilization mandatory for certain types of people in state custody. 30 different states and Puerto Rico soon followed with laws of their own. In the first half of the 20th century, approximately 60,000 Americans, mostly patients in mental institutions and criminals, were sterilized without their acquiescence. Roughly a third of all Puerto Rican women were sterilized after providing only the flimsiest consent. These laws were not entirely uncontroversial, and many were challenged in courts. but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in its now infamous 1927 Buck v. Bell decision that eugenics laws were constitutional. Three generations of imbeciles, progressive Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes disgracefully wrote in the decision, are enough. As the eugenics movement played out in the United States, another group of Europeans was watching closely. Nazism was, in many ways, a perverted heir of Darwinism. German scientists and doctors embraced Galton's eugenic theories from the beginning. In 1905, the Society for Racial Hygiene was established in Berlin with the express goal of promoting Nordic racial purity through sterilization and selective breeding. An Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Hygiene was soon opened in Frankfurt by a leading German eugenicist, Otmar Freiherr von Verschuer. Eugenic theories and U.S. efforts to implement them through state action were also very much on Adolf Hitler's mind as he wrote his ominous 1925 manifesto, Mein Kampf, in Landsberg prison. The stronger must dominate and not mate with the weaker, he wrote. Only the born weakling can look upon this principle as cruel, and if he does so, it is merely because he is of a feebler nature and narrower mind. For if such a law did not direct the process of evolution, then the higher development of organic life would not be conceivable at all. Since the inferior always outnumber the superior, the former would always increase more rapidly if they possessed the same capacities for survival and for the procreation of their kind, and the final consequence would be that the best in quality would be forced to recede into the background. Therefore, a corrective measure in favor of the better quality must intervene, for here a new and rigorous selection takes place, according to strength and health. One of the first laws passed by the Nazis after taking power in 1933 was the Law for the Prevention of Hereditary Defective Offspring, with language based partly on the Eugenic Sterilization Law of California. Genetic health courts were established across Nazi Germany, in which two doctors and a lawyer helped determine each case of who should be sterilized. Over the next 4 years, the Nazis forcibly sterilized an estimated 400,000 Germans. But simply sterilizing those with disabilities was not enough for the Nazis to realize their eugenic dreams. In 1939, they launched a secret operation to kill disabled newborns and children under the age of 3. This program was then quickly expanded to include older children, and then adults with disabilities considered to have lebensunwertes Leben, or lives unworthy of life. Making clear the conceptual origins of these actions lay in scientifically and medically legitimated eugenics. Medical professionals oversaw the murder of an ever-widening group of undesirables in gassing installations around the country. This model then expanded from euthanizing the disabled and people with psychiatric conditions to criminals and to those considered to be racial inferiors, including Jews and Roma, as well as homosexuals. It was not by accident that Josef Mengele, the doctor who decided who would be sent to the gas chambers at Auschwitz, was a former star student of von Verschuer at the Frankfurt Institute for Hereditary Biology and Racial Hygiene. By the mid-1930s, the American scientific community was pulling away from eugenics. In 1935, the Carnegie Institution concluded the science of eugenics was not valid and withdrew its funding for the Eugenics Records Office at Cold Spring Harbor. Reports of Nazi atrocities, amplified by the 1945-1946 Nuremberg trials, put the nail in the coffin of the eugenics movement in the West. Although eugenics laws were finally scrapped from the books only in the 1960s in the United States and the 1970s in Canada and Sweden, very few people were forcibly sterilized after the war. But as new technologies more recently began to revolutionize the human reproduction process and create new tools for assessing, selecting, or genetically engineering pre-implanted embryos, many critics raised the specter of eugenics. In his influential 2003 presidential address to the American College of Medical Genetics, and later in a published article, University of California, San Francisco pediatrician Charles Epstein provocatively asked, "Is modern genetics the new eugenics?" He answered that it had the potential to be, if the scientific community was not self-aware and careful. Harvard's Michael Sandel made a similar point in The Case Against Perfection. "Genetic manipulation seems somehow worse, more intrusive, more sinister, than other ways of enhancing performance and seeking success. This draws it disturbingly close to eugenics. Was the old eugenics objectionable only insofar as it was coercive? Or is there something inherently wrong with the resolve to deliberately design our progeny's traits? The problem with eugenics and genetic engineering is that they represent a one-sided triumph of willfulness over giftedness, of dominion over reverence, of molding over beholding." Leading bioethicist Arthur Kaplan argued, "Renegade scientists and totalitarian loonies are not the folks most likely to abuse genetic engineering. You and I are. Not because we are bad, but because we want to do good. In a world dominated by competition, parents understandably want to give their kids every advantage. The most likely way for eugenics to enter into our lives is through the front door, as nervous parents will fall over one another to be first to give Junior a better set of genes." The parallels between the ugly eugenics of the late 19th century and the first half of the 20th, and what's beginning to happen today, are not insignificant. In both cases, a science at an early stage of development, and with sometimes uncertain accuracy, was or is being used to make big decisions, forced sterilization of the feeble-minded in the old days, not selecting a given embryo for implantation or terminating a pregnancy based on genetic indications today. In both cases, scientists and government officials seek to balance individual reproductive liberty with broader societal goals. In both cases, future potential children lose the opportunity to be born. In both cases, societies and individuals make culturally biased but irrevocable decisions about which lives are worth living and which are not. These parallels offer us a powerful warning. But if we collectively paint all human genetic engineering with the brush of Nazi eugenics, we would kill the incredible potential of genetics technologies to help us live healthier lives. "If cannibalism is our greatest taboo," Oxford philosopher Richard Dawkins wrote, "positive eugenics is a candidate for the second. In our time, the word has a chilling ring. If a policy is described as eugenic, that is enough for most people to rule it out at once." Bioethicist Diane Paul writes that the term eugenics is wielded like a club. To label a policy eugenics is to say, in effect, that it is not just bad, but beyond the pale. That there probably is an element of eugenics in decisions being made today on the future of human genetic engineering should push us to be careful and driven by positive values, but the specter of past abuses should not be a death sentence for this potentially life-affirming technology or the people it could help. Unlike the earlier eugenics movement, today's models of prenatal testing and embryo selection are not state-controlled, coercive, racist, or discriminatory by standard uses of those terms. Modern eugenic aspirations are not about the draconian top-down measures promoted by the Nazis and their ilk, journalist John Enten writes. Instead of being driven by a desire to improve the species, new eugenics is driven by our personal desire to be as healthy, intelligent, and fit as possible, and for the opportunity of our children to be so as well. And that's not something that should be restricted lightly. Enten's point can be debated, but for our and our species' sake, we must be having the debate. A basic tenet of liberal societies is that, wherever possible, the individual should be protected from the excessive power of the state. One expression of this philosophy in many societies is the protection of a woman's right to make her own reproductive decisions on issues like contraception and abortion. Reproductive freedom, New Zealand philosopher Nicholas Agar writes in his book Liberal Eugenics in Defense of Human Enhancement, encompasses the choice of whether or not to reproduce, with whom to reproduce, when to reproduce, and how many times to reproduce. Liberal eugenics adds the choice of certain of your children's characteristics to that list of freedoms. Agar contrasts liberal eugenics with what he calls authoritarian eugenics, the idea that the state should determine what constitutes a good life. While old-fashioned authoritarian eugenicists sought to produce citizens out of a single centrally designed mold, Agar writes, the distinguishing mark of the new liberal eugenics is state neutrality. Access to information about the full range of genetic therapy will allow prospective parents to look to their own values in selecting improvements for future children. Authoritarian eugenicists would do away with ordinary procreative freedoms. Liberals instead propose radical extensions of them. As opposed to decisions made by governments in authoritarian systems based on race and class, liberal eugenics systems would focus on the individual. In the society Agar envisions, parents' particular conceptions of the good life would guide them in their selection of enhancements for their children, but these parental choices would need to be balanced by consideration of the broader societal impact of their individual decisions. Parental choice, however, is an important principle, but not an unlimited one. The United States, for example, has upheld the right of Amish parents to separate their children from modernity and of Hasidic Jews to raise their children speaking only Yiddish and not learning English. Many U.S. states offer less latitude for pregnant women who poison their fetuses through drug and alcohol use while pregnant, or for Christian Science parents who deny their children urgent medical care. It's also probably impossible to think of individual parental choices outside of the social and political context. Given that selecting embryos to avoid disease is already permitted in most jurisdictions around the world, it's unlikely other reproductive decisions intended to enhance the health and well-being of future children will be forever banned in most countries. When this happens, the essential question for parents will move from whether to select and ultimately manipulate embryos, but how much. Some will call this eugenics, but the connotations will change. In his provocative 2017 Los Angeles Times editorial, "Is There Such a Thing as Good Eugenics?" Adam Cohen asserts, 20th century eugenics has rightly been called a war on the weak. 21st century eugenics can be a war for the weak. This point is necessarily controversial, but just as genetically engineering our future children comes with a potential cost, so does the alternative. It's not that hard to imagine future scenarios when humans would need to genetically alter ourselves in order to survive a rapid change in our environment resulting from global warming or intense cooling following a nuclear war or asteroid strike, a runaway deadly virus, or some kind of other future challenge we can't today predict. Genetic engineering, in other words, could easily shift from being a health or lifestyle choice to becoming an imperative for survival. Preparing responsibly for these potential future dangers may well require we begin developing the underlying technologies today, while we still have time. Thinking about genetic choice in the context of imagined future scenarios is in many ways abstract, but potentially helping a child live a healthier, longer life is anything but. Every time a person dies, a lifetime of knowledge and relationships dissolves. We live on in the hearts of our loved ones, the books we write, and the plastic bags we've thrown away. But what would it mean if people lived a few extra healthy years because they were genetically selected or engineered to make that possible? How many more inventions could be invented, poems written, ideas shared, and life lessons passed on? What would we as individuals and as a society be willing to pay? What values might we be willing to compromise to make that possible? What risks would we individually and collectively be willing to take on? Our answers to these questions will both propel us forward and present us with some monumental ethical challenges. Some people today see diversity as a way to redress historical wrongs committed against minority populations. Others see it as a way of making sure our universities, corporations, governments, and other institutions benefit from a wide range of perspectives. All of these understandings miss an even more essential point. Diversity has been and remains the sole survival strategy of our species. Random mutation, one of the two pillars of Darwinian evolution, is just another name for the precursor of diversity. Diversity allowed our single-cell ancestors to morph into what we are today. Diversity was what both ensured those species without helpful adaptations would die off and those benefiting from adaptations more suitable to the changing world around them would thrive. Evolution sometimes feels like an inexorable progression from better to worse, from the knuckle-walking monkey to the upright man, but this is not the case. Evolution is directionless and agnostic about its winners and losers. Conditions are always changing, so evolving creatures generally have no sense they are evolving and no possible way of knowing which traits will be selected for or against in the context of future conditions they cannot imagine. If given a choice, monkeys in trees would probably choose to make themselves better climbers. Our tree-living ancestors must have looked at that first lunatic who climbed down as some type of freak, but the adaptations associated with savanna living conferred advantages that ensured the associated genetic mutations persisted. Most of our ancestors were not the first early humans to leave Africa, only the first early humans to leave Africa and ultimately survive. They lasted, presumably because they evolved a set of traits that gave them a better chance of survival within their new context. Had we asked our ancestors at the point of leaving Africa what traits they would need, they would have had no way of knowing. Genetic diversity conferred a range of traits, some of which made survival possible for a small subset of people. Diversity, therefore, is conferred upon us, but we would, by definition, be hard-pressed to overcome our biases of the present moment. Left to our own devices, we humans are easily swayed by what we see around us. A recent Australian study that reviewed the records of 154 women's selections of donors at a Queensland sperm bank found that women preferred well-educated, introverted, and analytical donors over those who were less educated, extroverted, and less methodical. If given the choice, it's a good guess that most parents would want smarter, taller, better-looking, and more compassionate kids because these traits are valued in today's world. Each of these traits, however, reflects our specific cultural bias. The closer we move toward sensitive and culturally significant issues like race, sexual orientation, and intelligence, the greater the danger we might collectively be swayed by pernicious social biases. Very often, concerned people ask me, in the question and answer session following my talks, whether embryo selection or gene editing could be used for parents to not have a gay child or to make sure their child is light-skinned. The answer is maybe. Although there is no single gay gene, the irrefutable case has been made through twin and genome-wide association studies that there is at least a significant genetic foundation to homosexuality. It would be impossible to today determine which among the 15 or so embryos being considered for implantation in the mother would have the greatest likelihood of being gay, but this may not always be the case. The same is true for skin color. A 2018 study by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania identified 8 genes that significantly influence a person's skin pigmentation. A single mutation of the SLC24A5 gene accounts for most of what we call white skin. It is likely that parents with different skin tones selecting from among their embryos will, in the not-too-distant future, be able to choose one that has a lighter or darker complexion. In the longer term, it will probably be possible to genetically edit a pre-implanted embryo or even perform gene therapy on adults to change their color. The usual human colors wouldn't necessarily be the only options. Japanese scientists have already used CRISPR to change the colors of flowers from purple to white by disrupting a single gene. It is only a matter of time until a wide range of color-changing options will be available to humans, should we choose to use them. Choices like these that could reduce human diversity would not only have significant and negative social implications, but also potentially expose us to yet unknown risks. Over the past 8,000 years, our ancestors domesticated corn to increase yield, but because this modified corn became so genetically homogeneous, its susceptibility to blight increased. Similarly, if enough people around the world start making individual decisions about their future children based on whatever cultural biases, we run the collective risk of weaponizing our biases and making our species more genetically uniform and less able to withstand some type of natural virus, germ warfare, or other yet unknown challenge in the future. If we don't recognize the evolutionary benefits of our diversity in its many facets, we run the risk of harming ourselves, even in the name of our individual and collective efforts to help ourselves. In 2017, a U.S. military contractor invited me to a conference that brought together futurists and military leaders to explore what impact the genetics revolution might have on the future of warfare and how the U.S. military might prepare. After dividing into breakout sessions designed to generate different scenarios for what might happen, each group came back to share their thoughts. The first team outlined how future soldiers could be genetically engineered to be great at pattern recognition. Why don't we just recruit high-functioning autistic people into the military who are already far better at solving certain types of cognitive problems than non-autistics? I piped in, trying not to be snarky. Why genetically engineer people with great pattern recognition when we already have them? These types of questions must broadly be asked as we enter the age of human genetic engineering. Why breed people for superior IQ when we could significantly enhance our society's collective intellectual and problem-solving capability by providing real opportunity and better schools to the least advantaged among us? Why use embryo selection to reduce the rates of bipolar disorder when some of the world's greatest artists are great because their brains function differently? These are tough questions for which there are no easy answers, but the idea of parents selecting embryos less likely to become gay adults or biracial parents choosing or gene-editing kids to be one color or another is not only morally repulsive, but also a potential blow to the beneficial diversity of our species. Because these could well be potential choices in the future, we must redouble our efforts today to find better and new ways to celebrate and invest in our diversity and ensure our common genetic data pool is diverse to prevent the genetic revolution from ultimately becoming a horror show. Diversity is our species' greatest asset, should we choose to embrace it. Reducing our diversity, even with the best of intentions, could become our Achilles heel. On the other hand, it would also be a mistake to over-fetishize every aspect of genetic diversity. A few genes can save us, others can kill us, and most everything else sits somewhere in the middle, being experienced differently in different contexts. To suggest we should accept the terrible genetic diseases that kill our children out of respect for genetic diversity, or that we should allow parents or scientists to engineer children with debilitating diseases to enhance diversity, would be preposterous. And as much as genetic engineering might be used to limit genetic diversity, it could also conceivably be used to enhance it. Either way, to realize the greatest upside of the genetic revolution, we will have to articulate, celebrate, and affirm in our individual and collective choices the value of diversity in the coming genetic age in a far more profound manner than we do today. Like diversity, issues of equity will also need to be front and center in our thinking. All technology has an uneven adoption curve. There's always a first person or a first group to have access to a particular advantageous technology. Scientists are divided about whether our Homo sapiens ancestors outcompeted, outhunted, outsurvived, and/or outhumped our Neanderthal cousins to extinction, but whatever the case, we used our tools, social strategies, sex organs, and brains to devastating impact. Tens of thousands of years later, the Mongols built the largest geographic empire in history, marrying the military advantage that stirrups gave their cavalry to a ruthless warrior culture and new ideas for social organization. Although China invented gunpowder and the compass, these technologies were fully weaponized into guns and warships by the Europeans, who used these capabilities to colonize the rest of the world. In each of these cases, a relatively small technological advantage was levered into decades or centuries of domination, or, in the case of the Neanderthals, extinction. There are many ways the unequal distribution of genetic technologies could lead to these kinds of frightening results. If only wealthy and otherwise advantaged people can select or genetically engineer their children to have certain useful traits, their children could come to dominate societies because of their real or perceived capabilities. Employers might not want to take the risk of hiring someone who was not enhanced if the odds of an enhanced person doing the same job better, by whatever metric, were statistically higher, or even if there was only a false perception this was the case. If enhancements are allowed and unequal access continues over time, each generation of an advantaged family could become more genetically enhanced than their disadvantaged peers until the difference between two groups becomes unbridgeable. But despite the critical importance of striving for greater levels of equality, absolute equality should not be a goal. The popular 1997 film Gattaca, in which an unenhanced young man wanting to become an astronaut is blocked because of his genetic profile, explored this idea. The protagonist eventually makes it to space through grit, wit, and wile. In real life, would a society really want a genetically non-enhanced person traveling to space if someone else was genetically optimized to be more resistant to radiation and maintain bone density better in a zero-gravity environment? Many technologies start out being used by a few elites before later reaching a wider audience. Meeting with female villagers participating in a microcredit program during my 2012 visit to Bangladesh, I was incredibly impressed by what all the women receiving the loans were doing to start small businesses and take care of their families, but saddened that they seemed to have little chance to do more. With my iPhone connecting me to the universal library of the Internet, I felt the already huge advantage of my privileged American birth widening. How could these poor people ever afford the expensive technological marvel I held in my pocket, I wondered. Today, Bangladeshi villagers can get a new smartphone for an affordable $60, and usage levels are skyrocketing. If we had demanded equal access to smartphones for everyone from the get-go, the smartphone industry would never have grown quickly enough to drive down prices to where these phones became accessible to poor people around the world. We've already explored how governments and insurance companies will be incentivized to promote embryo screening and then gene editing to eliminate genetic diseases and avoid the cost of providing a lifetime of care to those who would otherwise be born with those diseases or develop them later in life. But saying that companies and governments will be incentivized to make embryo screening and genetic engineering more widely available does not mean they will do it effectively, or at all, because even the inefficient status quo always has its protectors. On top of that, some parents with means will want to select and enhance their future children more aggressively, despite whether their governments or insurance companies will pay for it. There are no easy answers, but it's fair to ask whether preventing the first adopters from genetically enhancing their children would be the same as preventing the early adopters of smartphones and supercomputers from leveraging the advantages those technologies provided. And while many people fear a dystopian future of genetic determinism, the case for genetic identification should not be rejected out of hand. Mozart grew up in the Habsburg court, but how many Mozarts are today languishing in Syrian refugee camps? Will we always think it wrong for music programs to know which of their young applicants are genetically predisposed to having perfect pitch? Will we oppose the genetic screening of the world's most disadvantaged communities to identify children with tremendous genetic potential and give them a better shot at realizing that potential, or of all children to assess what teaching styles may best correspond to their learning abilities? No one wants to live in a society where people are pegged at birth for certain roles and never have the opportunity to find their passions and show what they can achieve, and we must do all we can to provide equal opportunity to everyone. But providing extra opportunities for people with remarkable genetic potential in one area or another may come over time to be seen as a service to disadvantaged communities, a boon to national competitiveness, and the good and right thing to do. It could well be that some of us will want, over the coming decades and centuries, for our children to have enhanced abilities and traits. Even if enhancements like these were not evenly distributed, a compelling case can be made that a small number of enhanced people, if motivated by positive values, could make tremendous contributions to various fields like science, philosophy, art, or politics that could make the world better for everyone. As we co-evolve with our technology, it may be that we'll need to generate a group of brilliant coders to extend the human role in our human-machine interface. It may be that human creativity and human qualities like empathy become so valued in an AI-defined world that we will start an arms race with each other to genetically engineer more empathic and creative children. As frightening as this might seem to some, restricting the genetic enhancement capacities we may need to maintain our species' position in a world of artificial superintelligence might end up being like limiting horse and buggy speeds at the dawn of the automotive age. Accepting that identifying genetic predispositions for a certain function could be justified, however, does not mean that we should passively accept a future where perceived capacities are determined by genetics, or where the gap between genetically enhanced and unenhanced people continually grows. After every talk I give on the future of human genetic engineering, someone asks about the future dangers of genetically engineered inequality. My answer is always the same. Genetic inequality should be a very real concern for our future. But if we are concerned about inequality at some distant point in the future, we should start living our values of equality today. Addressing the current difference between the average person listening to this book and the average resident of the Central African Republic would be a good place to start. Because of chronic civil war, 76% of the Central African Republic population lives in poverty, a quarter is displaced, half are food insecure, and 40% of young children are experiencing stunted growth. Widespread maternal malnutrition suggests that the cognitive function of these children is very likely, on average, significantly lower than that of average children born into more advantaged environments. In comparison to their Central African Republic counterparts, therefore, advantaged children from other countries are already genetically enhanced. If we care about equality and genetic equality, as we should, advocating for it in our divided world today will model our best values for tomorrow, when genetically engineered inequality becomes a possibility. As we aspire to live these values, however, we must also remember that some genetic inequality is part of being human, a central aspect of our diversity. The truest nightmare scenario for our species is not genetic inequality, but complete genetic equality. At the same time, inequality run amok would become a terrible nightmare. The Goldilocks solution to this challenge may be that we need to find a balance between the excesses of too much and too little genetic equality. But members of a hubristic species like ours must at least consider challenges to such a seemingly reasonable hypothesis. In his introduction of the idea of the Übermensch, or Superman, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche recognized what it meant that humans had not plopped on the earth fully made, as the Bible suggests, but were instead products of an ongoing evolutionary process with our current form only one step along the way. This transitory version of us, according to Nietzsche, was something to be overcome. All beings so far, he asked, have created something beyond themselves, and do you want to be the ebb of this great flood and even go back to the beasts rather than overcome man? Julian Huxley, a zoologist and leader of the British Eugenics Society and brother of Brave New World author Aldous, was an avowed eugenicist in the years before the Second World War who supported the voluntary sterilization of people with mental defects and restrictions on immigration into the United Kingdom. Even after Nazism drove a nail into the heart of the eugenics movement, Huxley struggled for years to define a more modern eugenics based on principles of scientific humanism. In 1957, the same year that the Soviets launched Sputnik and ushered the world into a new era of big science, he wrote in his essay Transhumanism that the human species can, if it wishes, transcend itself, not just sporadically, an individual here in one way, an individual there in another way, but in its entirety, as humanity. We need a name for this new belief. Perhaps transhumanism will serve, man remaining man, but transcending himself, by realizing new possibilities of and for his human nature. The human species can be on the threshold of a new kind of existence, as different from ours as ours is from that of Peking man. It will at last be consciously fulfilling its real destiny. In the years since, the transhumanist movement has grown from an intellectually aligned group of thinkers and technologists into a global movement with its own international association, manifesto, and even candidates for political office. Championed by brilliant thinkers like Hans Moravec, Ray Kurzweil, and Nick Bostrom, transhumanists, according to the 1998 Transhumanist Declaration, believe that humanity's potential is still mostly unrealized. This potential can be broadened by overcoming aging, cognitive shortcomings, involuntary suffering, and our confinement to planet Earth. Individual humans should be afforded wide personal choice over how they enable their lives, including the use of techniques that may be developed to assist memory, concentration, and mental energy, life extension therapies, reproductive choice technologies, cryonics procedures, and many other possible human modification and enhancement technologies. Like eugenics and most religions before it, transhumanism imagines a world where humans transcend the limitations of their current biology. But while Nietzsche's imagining of the Übermensch gained sinister implications, the transhumanists and others like them are imagining an uber-intelligence combining human and machine capabilities into a seamless web of evolutionary revolution. These ideas are at the same time frightening and tantalizingly appealing. The entire history of human existence has been marked by our incessant struggle to increase our chances of survival by becoming better at securing calories, protecting ourselves from the elements, and procreating. With every three steps forward we've made as a species, we've fallen two steps back as lifetimes of learning succumb to the aging decay of our brains and the destruction of death. If genetic technologies help us live healthier and longer, retain knowledge, and do many other things better, or even just make us feel we have the capacity to fight back against the caprice of our own biology, the magnetic pull of using these technologies will prove collectively irresistible. But the intellectual connectivity between eugenics and transhumanism faces all of us as a warning. Saying that we will and probably should do something does not mean that there should be no limits. Even the most liberal societies have laws regulating what people can and can't do in their intimate lives and beyond. The future of genetic engineering is in many ways the future of humanity. To enable our future, it must be embraced. To save us from ourselves, however, it must be regulated. The challenge we face today, however, is that while the science is advancing exponentially, public understanding of it is only increasing linearly. The regulatory structures needed to find the right balance between scientific progress and ethical constraint are only inching forward glacially. And all of this is happening in a world where significant cultural and societal differences, driven by ever greater levels of competition within and between societies, make it ever more difficult to find common ground.